Here we go. Quiet!
Quiet!
Problem!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we look at the current film news, movies of yesterday and today, and try to make some sense of it all. Across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing writer Natasha Bogutsky.
And across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief Rich Dries. So, Rich, how's everything going this week?
It's going pretty well. And yourself?
Not too bad. We had a lot of stuff happen this week, not in film news.
It was kind of a slow film news week. I think partially in regards to other things that have been going on
in the news
nationally. And to be honest, probably the worst week to be launching a podcast about film news, because there are so many other things that are so much more important that we need to, as a nation, concentrate on. And I don't mean to get so heavy, literally, 1 minute into this podcast.
No, I completely agree with you, though.
At the same time,
we have the Oscars coming up this week. So yes, we have to.
Well, I was going to say, even more so than that, you know, movies are more of a communal event where people of different backgrounds come together into a room and enjoy the same common experience, hopefully, at least. I wouldn't say that, you know, movies are the solutions to everybody's problems. They're certainly not the cause of everybody's problems.
No.
As some people would
call them,
imagine and believe.
A temporary escape.
Yeah, and sometimes we need that.
Yeah.
And people were certainly escaping this weekend to see Black Panther again. How's that for a great segue?
Oh, Ryan Coogler must be very happy.
Ryan Coogler, Kevin Feige at Marvel, everybody at Disney. And, well, they should be happy. And they should be getting this success because, you know, we both agree this is a marvelous movie. No pun intended.
No, it really was. I can't rave enough about Black Panther. Granted, every person that I want to rave to about it has seen it already.
Broke, you know, box office records like crazy last weekend. And then this weekend, as we record Sunday morning, it's looking like it's going to be doing $108 million for its second
million?
Weekend. $108 million at the box office for its second weekend, raising its overall domestic total over 10 days to over $400 million.
Wow. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
For two weekends?
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Took the Avengers, the original Avengers movies, 14 days to get to $400 million. But Star Wars The Force Awakens hit that in 8 days.
Obviously.
So
it's Star Wars.
Yeah, but for a Marvel movie, obviously Marvel's a great name brand. People, you know to go when a new Marvel film opens up. Even by Marvel standards, this thing is a runaway monster hit. And that's amazing to me. I also think, much the way Wonder Woman was also a surprise runaway hit, it speaks to a fact that there's an audience out there for action films or films in general that don't necessarily headline white guys. I'll say it. You know, it'll be blunt about it. You know, the African-American community is vastly underserved by major film releases. I think women, you know, basically 51% of our population is underserved by most major releases, although we're starting to see a shift in that a little bit more.
Good. Marvel, take a hint. Put out a female-led Marvel film.
Well, we've got Captain Marvel coming out next year with Brie Larson.
I know. I'm so excited for that.
But also, I mean, just this year, though, you know, in terms of female-led movies, we've had Annihilation, which opened this week, and we're going to discuss a little bit later on. And we have Red Sparrow.
Coming out this weekend.
Coming up this weekend, yeah. So I think, you know, definitely that studios are thinking and looking at that. And I'm not saying we're going to have an explosion of films the way, like, we had the blaxploitation film explosion in the 70s following the release of Shaft.
Yeah.
But then again, we've got a new Shaft movie coming up next year, so...
Oh, speaking of female-led movies, there's also another one for this month.
Oh, Wrinkle in Time.
Well, there's that, but
okay.
I was thinking...
Oh, there's another.
Tomb Raider.
Tomb Raider. That's right. I keep forgetting about that.
Alicia Vikander.
Okay. And that she's the reason that excites me. I'm not a big video game guy. I think there really hasn't been a great video game movie adaptation yet. There have been some good ones. Nothing great, though. And hopefully she'll be able to deliver a great film adaptation of a video game. Then again, I hope that Michael Fassbender was going to do that with Assassin's Creed last year, and that was a big dud.
True. For me, the ultimate female action hero is Angelina Jolie.
Oh, yeah.
She has had so many action hits that she has skyrocketed through the roof at what she is able to do as an actress physically.
And, you know, she's been able to parlay that into a directing career as well, which is great.
But as much as I loved her in the role of Lara Croft, the films themselves were not good films.
No, they weren't.
Whereas this one, if I have seen correctly, a lot of the shots from the trailer seem like they're taken directly from the video games.
Okay.
Like when she's running across a log over a waterfall, and at one point she falls and hits it and rolls. Those are actual pieces from the video game that you had to do.
Oh, okay. And I'm sure that including that into the marketing was very intentional.
Oh, I'm sure it was. But I'm hoping that because of its faithfulness, we might actually see a better movie. I hope.
Well, there's always that tension between a faithful adaptation versus an adaptation that works as a good movie.
That is true.
I think the first two Harry Potter films are very faithful adaptations, slavishly so, and I think that inhibits them as being good movies. As much as I like Chris Columbus as a director, I think he was kind of, it always felt a little too beholden to the source material. And then once, you know, the latter films come in and they start to...
Well, you're getting darker anyways. Yeah.
That could be it too.
And Chris Columbus has always had a relatively light touch. I mean, going back to Home Alone.
True. He's always had that light touch as a director. But seriously think, though, remember, his first real credit as a filmmaker was writing the script for Gremlins, which is a dark, dark movie. Everybody thinks, oh, Gizmo's so cute and not a dime. That's a twisted movie. They shoot that granny through the chimney or whatever.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
Yeah, she's not, this is, they treat a lot of it as a cartoon, but granny ain't coming back from that.
No.
She's dead.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, so basically, Zach Gallagher's character is responsible for an old lady's death, when you think about it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Welcome to Rich Ruins Movies. Oh, wait, no, I think Doug Benson already does that podcast.
I would still say, though, when it comes to the Harry Potter, they had the best finish of any saga I have ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always inherent in the material, though, there.
True, but when you're looking at Star Wars or Star Trek or any other franchise that has given an ending... Well, Divergent never finished, but you've got Maze Runner, Hunger Games, all of the Twilight. You had all these franchises. The one that had the biggest ending, and I mean the best, storyline-wise, acting-wise, goes to Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Okay. Well, they also had the longest time to build up a lot of elements that would have story payoff and emotional payoff for viewers, so... At that point...
The fact that they were able to last that long, I'm impressed with.
the fact that they were actually able to do an eight, you know, a seven book series as an eight films and stick the landing and be consistently making good films, or at least good films, and is a testament to everybody involved. Not just the source material, but, you know, every director who worked on that franchise, Steve Kloves, I think, who... adapted every novel except for one of them as the screenwriter. So
all the cast that they had a big cast.
ridiculously big cast.
Yeah. You know, it was like the Game of Thrones of movies. And they're all British.
True. And if you are a British, you know, noted British actor who didn't go through the Harry Potter series, what the hell's wrong with your agent? Because everybody went through those movies. It was ridiculous.
It was popular at the time period, yeah, too.
And I'm going to draw a weird parallel here really quickly and then get us back on the course for whatever the heck we're supposed to be talking about next. A lot of people like the old 1966 Batman TV series with Adam West because it was all campy and fun. And it had like this really brief, giant explosion of becoming the pop culture zeitgeist moment.
All right.
And the reason you saw so many famous people on that show as bad guys, or even sometimes when like Batman and Robin are doing the climb up the side of the building and somebody pops out of the one of the windows and says, you know, they trade a joke before going on like Sammy Davis Jr. would. It's all because that thing was like so massively popular for about 2 years. Everybody wanted to be on that show. So suddenly you have Otto Preminger, for of all people, playing Mr. Freeze. You have Vic Buono, you know, a very noted comic at the time, playing King Tut. You got Cesar Romero playing the Joker. You got, you know, all those, you know, these actors. You're like, what? Roddy McDowall? Why is he doing a silly kid show? Oh, he's playing Bookworm, but everybody wanted to be on that show. And people were calling their agent saying, you know, my kids love Batman. Get me on Batman. So I saw that same effect with the Harry Potter casting a lot.
Okay. And speaking of Batman, how about Batgirl?
Oh, poor, poor Batgirl. No, not Yvonne Craig. The Warner Brothers planned Batgirl movie. Joss Whedon announced this week that he was stepping away from the project, which is a shame because, as we all know, any of us who followed Joss's career since the Buffy the Vampire TV series.
Oh, my Buffy.
He's great with, you know, action series with female leads, and this certainly seemed right within his wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. It was like one of those, when they announced it last year, it was one of those no duh moments, I thought. And he just said he had trouble cracking a story for it.
Really?
Yeah. And I can't say I blame him. You know, exactly in his statement, he's like, Batgirl is such an exciting project, and Warner's DC such collaborative and supportive partners. It took me months to realize I didn't really have a story. End quote. And I can't say I don't blame him for stepping away. I admire the honesty. I'm a little disappointed and a little puzzled that, what, you're Joss Whedon, though, dude. You should have been able to come up with a story and some themes and everything, which makes me wonder, you know, what was DC looking for? What was Warner's looking for that
wouldn't have been up as
he wasn't interested in? Yeah. Or did he have some ideas that they weren't interested in? And is this just a better way or a more diplomatic way of saying, quote unquote, creative differences?
Did he say I failed at one point in his statement?
Yeah. In the second half of the statement actually was, I'm grateful to Jeff and Toby. That's Jeff Johns and Toby Emmerich. And everybody who are at DC, okay. And back to the quote. And everyone who was welcoming when I arrived and so understanding when I, is there a sexier word for failed? Yeah, so again, he's being his usual self-effacing self, mm-hmm. which is always, you know, nice and a breath of fresh air compared to how, you know, other people often act.
He's taking it upon himself rather than putting it on anyone else, whether or not it is on anyone else. Mm-hmm. Falling on his sword, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, there are a lot of other factors involved here, I think.
I'm pretty certain there are, too.
Yeah, I'm sure no matter what he did and how hard he worked and how Warner saw him working hard to try to bring Justice League to a point that they wanted it at for release following Zack Snyder's departure, I'm sure a lot of the criticism over how that film came out possibly impacted. Played into. Yeah. There's also a rumor going around, and I first heard it actually about 2 weeks ago, and Bill Gadavaskis, the Film Buff Online comic book film editor, and I had a discussion about it. We didn't really want to give it too much credence at the time, and we kind of revisited the decision this past week about that rumor, and we decided not to put it into the story, but the rumor after the Joss Whedon thing came out after, you know, we published, the rumor started to get a little more steam. So I did want to just give it a quick address here. And the rumor is this. Joss Whedon was never going to be making a Batgirl movie. That was a smokescreen, if you will, for him coming over to Warner Brothers to do what he was going to do on Justice League.
Okay.
It kind of pairs up with another rumor that had circulated again recently that Zack Snyder was fired from Justice League a couple of months before the tragic family incident that was used as the reason why he was stepping away from the project. That happened, if I have my timeline correct, that family tragedy happened March of last year.
It did.
And he stepped away, I think, end of April, beginning of May, somewhere in there. And that's when they announced Joss Whedon was going to come in and just, you know, finish the film as per Snyder's notes. The new rumor is saying, oh, no, he was actually fired off of Justice League before that family tragedy in March of last year. So I could sort of see that, but, I sort of see how these two rumors line up. But part of me is thinking, that's a lot of...
hearsay?
That's a lot, yeah. Well, first of all, yes, it's a lot of hearsay. Some of the reporting I've seen on that rumor has said we have not been able to confirm it from sources at Warner Brothers. It's just scuttlebutt around town. Also, it seems a little too Machiavellian.
Yeah.
It's a little too complicated. And sometimes Occam's razor needs to be brought in. And the simplest answer is the truth. And I don't think that was really the case. I think at worst, Warner Brothers was looking to bring Joss Whedon in to do something with Justice League. But they also wanted him in for a Batgirl film. You know, at the time, remember, Joss Whedon was only doing some uncredited script rewrites that Snyder was going to direct in terms of reshoots.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so I think that's actually how it happened. You know, Snyder, you know, had the family tragedy. He decided he was going to try to work through it as a way of dealing with that grief. And then Joss Whedon was brought in to do the Batgirl film, also do a little, you know, give a hand with some of the rewriting. Yeah, I think it plays out pretty much the way we have been told it did. Until somebody were to actually go on the record, that's pretty much my opinion on that. So,
and speaking of, didn't Whedon actually write a first draft for Wonder Woman that was never done?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that was years ago. When Joel Silver's production shingle was still at Warner Brothers, he had the rights for Wonder Woman and was constantly trying to develop that. Joss Whedon did do a one draft on a version, kind of a kitchen sink draft. It's a good draft. It's not a great script, but you know, it's a rough draft for goodness sakes. It's a pencil sketch. It's not gonna be knocked out of the park right there. I know some fans have been like, "Oh, I read Joss Whedon's script. It's terrible." It's a first draft, you dummies. You know, let him polish it. Let him go through three or four drafts. Get some notes. Think about it, and I'm sure you know it would have improved, folks.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
A lot of scripts generally get better. I had a first or second draft of the script for Black Swan.
Uh-huh.
And there was a scene actually where she was peeling her skin like an onion. That was actually the line written into the script.
Oh, gross.
Yeah. It as you can see, the film, so much better.
So much better without them ripping off Poltergeist?
I forgot about that, but yeah.
But Whedon's script for Wonder Woman was just one of many scripts that they wrote. There's about three or four different, entirely different takes on the material that I've managed to read over the years.
Okay.
And most of them aren't that good. The best one actually was set, you know, and was a World War II era Wonder Woman story, and Steve Trevor's in it and everything. And I really kind of liked it, but I can see after Captain America, the first Avenger came out, they would want to change that.
Not make it World War II. Yeah,
ultimately go the way they did, and I think we're all the better for it.
Yes.
So that means ultimately we're not going to be seeing a Joss Whedon Batgirl film.
But we are going to be seeing Jurassic World 3.
Hey, none of us have seen Jurassic World 2 yet, so why not schedule a third film? Thank you, Universal, for that.
I guess that means that they are very optimistic about this.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yes, so mark your calendars, kids. June 11th, 2021. We're going to see Jurassic World 3.
I'm hoping for more Carnotaur. because when I saw the trailer for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, mm-hmm. there was a shot of a Carnotaur. And for any of you who watched the Disney's animated dinosaurs film that came out in the early 2000s, the Carnotaurs were terrifying. They were the thing of nightmares for me. The hell with the T-Rex. The Carnotaurs with those horns on their head was just... As I grew up, I love them.
Okay. Interesting.
But in the Fallen Kingdom trailer, you get a quick shot, and then the T-Rex takes it down. So I'm hoping for more.
At first, I was a little concerned because I was like, I didn't know you're a dinosaur nerd, but now you have like this this deep-rooted psychological fear of them. Okay.
Just one type.
Yet again, another example of Disney emotionally scarring somebody.
At least it wasn't a Velociraptor. I wasn't scarred by them as kids.
That's true. But honestly, though, I can't really blame Universal too much for already digging into work on a third Jurassic World movie. The first movie opened to like $1.6 billion with a B.
Yeah, that was insane. I remember when that came out, and it blew up everywhere.
No one was expecting it. And what was it, a combination of people were excited to see giant dinosaurs, nostalgia for the original films?
Chris Pratt, I think, was a big thing.
Coming off of Guardians.
Yeah, I was in New York City for a weekend. Actually, the weekend Jurassic World came out. Mm-hmm. Times Square was lit up with Jurassic World posters and all kinds of things. Right above...
Gee, gaudy advertising in Times Square? What are the odds?
No, I mean, when I... talk gaudy, I mean, it was as big as Batman versus Superman when they did that advertising. Mm-hmm. There was a huge, big marketing moving poster right above, mm-hmm. I think it was Toys R Us, which is no longer there. But it was him on the motorcycle with the Raptor pack. Mm-hmm. Gotta admit, it's the coolest shot in the film.
Yeah, it is a cool shot, yeah. You know, somebody sees, oh, guy on a motorcycle with dinosaurs. I need to see that. You can't not see that. You know, right now all they're doing is investing a little bit of cash into Colin Trevorrow working on a script with a new writer to the franchise. Her name is Emily Carmichael. She worked on Pacific Rim Uprising, which we're going to see in a couple of months. And she also worked on Disney's Black Hole remake for Tron Uprising director Joseph Kosinski. Is that right? Tron Uprising?
Tron Legacy.
Sorry. Tron Uprising was the cartoon, wasn't it?
I think so. It was the video game.
I'm blaming Pacific Rim Uprising for that mistake. Come on, guys. New words for subtitles, please.
Wait, hang on. They're remaking the Black Hole?
Yes. Well, Kosinski, even back when Tron Legacy came out, said that's what he wanted to do. And that was 5-6 years ago now. Honestly, Black Hole's is kind of a weird movie to begin with.
Yeah.
And I rewatched it a couple of years back.
But Anthony Perkins.
I know. He's good in it. Maximilian Schell. It's a crazy cast. Robert Forrester. Ernest Borgnine, of course.
Of course.
And it's just like this weird movie. It's got some great moments, like when they're trying to escape and they're going across the bridge and the meteor's plowing down the thing. It makes no logical sense, but it's a cool visual. And then, of course, you know, because it's a kid's film, let's have killer robots that, you know, have whirling blades that go into your chest. And a super psychedelic, trippy ending that makes no sense whether you're straight or high, I don't think.
I think that's also a sign of the times.
No.
The style.
I don't know. I think they were about 10 years late on the whole, let's get all trippy and far out and groovy. It's like Disney does 2001. Crossed with some kind of like weird morality. Oh, they go through hell to come out into another universe. What?
Well, you know how I feel about 2001, which we'll get to in a little while with Annihilation.
Okay. And those are the big news stories. And we'll be right back, though, in just a moment to look at a trailer that just dropped this week. Okay, not a lot of trailers dropped this week. The one trailer of note that we saw
And the only trailer that dropped this week.
Pretty much. Okay, yeah. Is our first look at a new film with Saoirse Ronan. And it's based on a novel. It's called On Chisel Beach.
We're here. Married.
Nothing went wrong.
Even my mother behaved herself.
You set eyes on me for the first time.
Hello.
Hello.
And I saw a man who wasn't wearing a jacket.
Nonsense.
Oh, yes.
And trousers with a mend in the knee.
Did you think then it was love at first sight?
Marry that girl.
Edward.
What?
Actually, I'm a little bit scared.
Okay, what did you think of that?
I am on the fence about it.
Oh?
I like how the trailer was done, definitely. Mm-hmm. It gives enough without giving too much away. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes the audience really think about it, more or less about how did these characters get to this place? What is going on? What's the motivation behind it?
It looks like a kind of a class struggle story. Is it post-war?
I'd say it's 50s. England. It looked
late 50s. Late 40s, early 50s, somewhere in there.
I would definitely go 50s on that. Mm-hmm.
Now, the book that it's based on, the guy also wrote Atonement. And I know, you love that movie. I find it morally reprehensible.
I love the movie. I love the book.
I think the movie at least asks the audience to forgive someone who callously lied and wrecked the lives of two people. And just because she feels bad about it decades later when she's an old woman, I think is kind of a... I don't think the movie earns it, and I just don't like it.
Oh, no. The book asks the same thing. It mm-hmm. The ending is a little different mm-hmm. from the movie, but the sentiment is still the same.
Okay.
So, yeah, believe me, I'm right there with you, but it is a well-done film.
Oh, it's well crafted.
Yes,
and you know everybody talks about the that long single tracking shot on the beaches of Dunkirk,
5 minute long one shot. Yeah.
And rightly so. It's very well done. It's very finely crafted. It's a beautifully shot film. I just reacted badly to it. I guess I don't know. I was just like, no movie. I am not going to forgive this person, and damn you for asking me to.
I feel...
Maybe I'm just a grouch. I don't know.
No. You're not a grouch. And I happen to agree with you. I actually find the first half of the film to be more impactful to me than mm-hmm. the second half of the film. But I'm not going to watch half a movie. I'm not that person. Uh-huh. When I sit down, I can't skip around. I don't start a movie midway through. I don't stop a movie midway through. I have to watch it from start to finish.
But if you only watched half a movie, The Sound of Music ends with them getting married and nothing bad happens to Austria ever.
But it's the 40s. Something bad happens to Austria.
Yes.
So there's no getting around the historical events.
But if you stop Sound of Music halfway through,
I'm
nothing
good.
Nothing bad, happy ending.
Well, the same could be said of watching My Fair Lady halfway through. You finish off the horse race and you never get to the ball.
True. But yeah, so this is coming out later on this year, and we're just got the giggles now.
It should also be said that Saoirse Ronan has been in both of the adaptations of Ian McEwan's work, On Chisel Beach and Atonement.
True.
Which the latter, she actually earned her first Academy Award nomination for Best mm-hmm. Supporting Actress, I think at the age of 13.
What have I done with my life?
And now she's... Oh, God, what, she's 23, 24, mm-hmm. and she's already on her third with Lady Bird.
Start from the beginning.
What do you think I do when you're away?
You think I'm out in the garden pining, looking up at the sky?
Why aren't you here?
I gotta leave a day early.
Your husband's here.
Let me see him.
He's extremely ill.
You have to tell me where he was, what he was doing.
It was his decision to go in. It's something they termed the Shimmer.
We've sent in drones and teams of people, but nothing comes back.
But something has.
You're a biologist. You served in the military.
If I knew what happened, I could save his life.
The boundary's getting bigger, it's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside. So do I. It's beautiful.
Opening up in theaters around the country this week is Annihilation, the latest film from Alex Garland, the director who brought us Ex Machina from 2015. A fantastic film, very smart science fiction film, very literate science fiction film, as is this movie. Annihilation stars Natalie Portman as a scientist who's also an ex-soldier who leads a team of scientists and soldiers into an area of swampland that's been overtaken by an alien influence called the Shimmer. They're looking for answers. They're not even sure what the questions are, though, I found in the film. I really like this movie. It's very dense and requires a lot of unpacking and quite possibly more than just the one viewing that we had of it this week. What was your impressions of it, though?
I need a rewatch. That was the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah, I think it was, oddly enough, you know, just casually chatting with a couple of the other journalists who were at that screening, you know, when we were there. I think that was just about everybody's reaction. Like, I need to see this again. And not just because I was, like, blown away by this movie, but there's certainly that there. But like I said,
it's so intricate that certain parts you could easily miss because mm-hmm. you're so wrapped up in the stunning visuals in mm-hmm. this film.
Oh, yeah. I find it interesting that, again, Garland is working, you know, with the theme of identity at some point, and I'm trying to skirt around what I want to say because I think it involves some spoilers, and there are certain things that, you know, people just need to discover
on their own.
Yes, as they're watching this film on their own. But again, it's kind of a, and I can't even, you know, there's one thing about the ending, you know, where I could draw a parallel to something else that he's done. And even there, I feel a little bad that I might be getting into some spoilery territory.
I think you're in the clear. That okay. doesn't really give away many spoilers. All we'll say is that piece that he's comparing it to is in Ex Machina.
Okay. I was going to just even leave it at that. But yes, this movie has an ending, by the way. The credits roll, and the lights come up, and everybody wanders out to their car and has a long discussion.
Long discussion. We had a 2-hour drive back, and that's pretty much all we talked about on the way home.
That is true, yeah.
This movie, because there is just so much mm-hmm. to talk about.
And even just talking about the nature of, like, Portman's relationship and the flashbacks we see to it, her character is married to Oscar Isaac's character, and how that begins to unfold. There's so much about this movie that just works right towards the ending, though, that it is one of those things that's honestly, it is difficult to talk about without getting into crazy spoilers.
Yeah, because everything seems, as a movie should, lead up to mm-hmm. the ending. But no, it feels like they were setting up the end even as far as the first freaking shot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would definitely, you know, definitely
so you can't,
agree there.
It's honest. He's right when we say this is a hard movie to talk about because every little piece feels like the end of the movie mm-hmm. because it is shot to lead up to that point.
And this is probably a terrible movie to be reviewing on our premiere podcast simply because this is one of those rare movies where you can't discuss certain things about the film and still leave it semi-spoiler free.
Yeah.
So honestly, this is like just one of those, and I hate reviews like this, but just go see it. Trust us. You'll love it. But if you did like Ex Machina,
you should like this. But it is one of those films that you either are going to come out going, I liked it, I hate it, or I haven't decided because I need to see it again.
Yeah. It's a very literate science fiction film. If you like film, you know, your science fiction films to have some thematic weight to them and deal with some interesting issues and questions, this is, you know, this would be probably up your alley. If you liked Ex Machina, if you liked how Ex Machina worked with those types of themes as well, then I would say definitely go see it.
We mentioned that this film is cerebral. Mm-hmm. Would it be more so than the film that is coming out in a couple of weeks called A Wrinkle in Time? Would you consider its style and storyline to be pretty close to?
Well, they're both based on books. Annihilation, Annihilation is based on a book I have not read, but from what I understand is the first of a trilogy of books, and the ending is different in the film.
I heard that too.
The Wrinkle in Time, of course, is also based on the Newbery Award-winning children's novel, young adult's novel, by Madeline Lingle, and I have read it. But it's been about 30-some years since I read it.
And it's been 11 for me.
Okay. So it's not, honestly, it's not very fresh in my memory. And I kind of like that, so I can kind of go into the movie and just judge that on itself.
All right.
As I remember the film, it does, yeah, or excuse me, as I remember the book, it did, you know, have some interesting themes. It dealt with some, you know, interesting, at least kind of cutting edge to my teenage mind. Science ideas involving tesseracts and things like that, the nature of good and evil is, and such, as if I recall correctly. So I'm interested to see how the film will explore that stuff. And I think, honestly, it's been a good year and a half or so for smart science fiction. I mean, I love the Star Wars films, but they're not literate science fiction.
That's
they're
what
not
I literary meant science when fiction. When I was bringing up mm-hmm. that question, was the idea of literary science, literal science versus literary science fiction. Would you say that this film is heavy on one more than the other?
For Annihilation? No, I think it strikes a nice balance between spectacle, which we, you know, mentioned briefly. The visuals here are stunning. Inside the shimmer is kind of like this energy field that's slowly expanding outwards through the Florida swamp.
It looks like oil when you've dropped water in it. It has that
water when you dropped oil in it.
You know what I meant.
Yes.
It has that shine that you would see at a gas station on a rainy day with the oil and the water spots on the ground that you try to step over and try to miss.
Yeah, but what's nice about that is that's what the shimmer looks like, what sunlight in the shimmer looks like. You don't see like a shaft of yellow sunlight, maybe some dust motes in it or something.
No.
You see that shaft of light with that oily film to it. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, oily rainbow film.
Yeah.
And it's very beautiful and just otherworldly enough to kind of put you a little bit on edge about what's going on.
Talk the mutations for a moment.
Sure. There's, okay, minor spoiler for once you get past the first act of the film, there is inside the shimmer, some animals and plant life are being mutated by the shimmer. Some of them are very stunning and beautiful.
And some of them, not so stunning and beautiful, and more or less gory and terrifying to look at.
Yeah, there are a couple of brief moments of outright horror.
Oh.
There's a couple of sequences of longer extended tension that build up towards something and keep you on the edge of your seat. I'm not sure I would call, you know, the film a horror film, though.
No, it's not a horror film, but it does have elements of horror and, as you said, tension to it. It's mm-hmm. it's more about the build than it is the payoff, but it does give you a good payoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Hitchcock said, there's more tension to be found in a scene where four people are sitting around a table with a bomb strapped underneath it, and you know that the bomb is there, than just a scene of four people sitting around the chair table, and then suddenly something explodes.
Yeah, well, he was the master of suspense.
So. True. And we're both Hitchcock fans.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a couple, there's one or two moments of just a plane bomb exploding.
Oh, yeah.
But there's also a lot of sitting around waiting for that bomb to explode. And we know it's coming.
It feels like this film is a slow build. Mm-hmm. But that's what makes it so good.
If this sounds like your cup of tea, if you liked Arrival, if you liked Blade Runner 2049, if you liked Ex Machina,
2001 Space Odyssey.
there's a hint of 2001 Space Odyssey in there. We're not going to say how much more.
No.
Although, now that I think about that, I think there is more to explore in that idea. But again, that's spoiler territory. But
we can't get into it.
No, I don't want to get into it. Oh boy. But if you like any of those types of movies, you know, science fiction films that really make you think, you know, like I said, more like literary science fiction, then definitely give Annihilation a look this weekend. And we'll be right back in just a moment with the other thing that's coming up next weekend, the Oscars.
The Academy Award for Best Picture.
You like me right now. You like me.
And now for the topic that I've been waiting to discuss since the beginning of this podcast. My second Christmas is coming up this weekend, the Oscars.
Ah, yes, the Oscars. That wonderful award show where when they agree with your taste, the Oscars are wonderful. When they disagree with what you feel should win, they are the worst things ever.
I beg to differ. Well, maybe I could just be objective about it.
Well, it's true. And in some ways it is true.
It is
that,
true,
you know, people are like, oh, I love the Oscars because Return of the King got all the Oscars. And somebody will sit there and go, yeah, but the Oscars suck because they gave Best Picture to Annie Hall instead of Star Wars back in 1978. So,
okay, that is true, and I have to admit that when someone calls out someone I've been rooting for, I start screaming and jumping around the parlor. Mm-hmm. That also being said, when they call ones that I don't see coming, I'm like, okay, I didn't see that one coming. I'm going to write that down because I may not have seen that film, and I want to go back and check it out.
And that's where I think the Oscars actually really work their best magic, is when they highlight films that are worthwhile seeing.
Yeah.
Do they always do it? No. But I think they have a pretty good track record. And I think if you just look at this year's Best Picture nominees, the 9 nominees that we have are all really great films,
they
I think.
They are. I feel that there is a movie on there that maybe doesn't need to be headlined as
Which
much.
Which one would that be?
3 Billboards for Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
You're not a fan.
No. I loved the movie.
Okay.
I thought it had brilliant performances all around. Mm-hmm. From Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big Sam Rockwell fan, and even I have to admit, I liked him in this movie.
At some point, we will have a long discussion about why you're not a Sam Rockwell fan, and why that's just morally wrong.
It's probably a mix of Zathura and Iron Man 2 that turned me off.
Okay, Iron Man 2 I could see, but we'll find some good... We'll find some good Sam Rockwell for you.
Okay. It had brilliant writing. The ending was not what I expected it to be. Mm-hmm. I was actually rooting for this film when I first saw the trailer, but then I saw it a couple weeks back, and I feel like I, Tonya, should have been in that place.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of films I was like, boy, I really wish they had gotten the Best Picture nod. But for me, just looking down the list, there's probably not a spot where I would take a film out. Usually when you look at a list and you go, ugh, that film. Honestly, the film I'm the least enthusiastic about is probably Darkest Hour.
Okay.
But it's still a good film, and I can see why it's on the list. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. I would love to, with you, in fact, I would love to see I, Tonya up there as well. That's personally one of my favorite films of the year.
Well, actually, if you count the nominees, we have 9 this year. Mm-hmm. A decade ago, they stretched it from 5 to 10. So technically, there still is a space to put I, Tonya on this list.
There is, but there's also that really weird mathematical equation to get a full 10 nominees in there. It involves pluralities of nominations and stuff like that. It's very odd. I've tried to figure it out. I read the rule. I understand the rule for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then don't ask me to explain it because I can't. Suddenly it just goes. It's like the rules to Baccarat in Ian Fleming's novel, yeah, Casino Royale. He does a great job explaining how Baccarat works.
And then after you put the book down, you can't remember what you read.
Exactly. You read it, you're thinking, I am heading right to a casino, and I am going to own everything. But by the time you get your tuxedo on, you've already forgotten how that works.
The fact that you think you'd put a tuxedo on to go to our local casino.
I've done it.
High roller here.
Oh, yeah. Show me the way to the $5 blackjack table. Anyways, Oscars. Yeah, I think there's a lot of great nominees this year. And if you kind of gauge your movie-going experience or what you're going to rent at Redbox or on Amazon or whatever by the nominees, you're not going to go wrong with Call Me By Your Name or Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird.
Shape of Water.
Shape of Water is fantastic. Get Out is amazing. Phantom Thread's a great film. Not for everybody, I would say, but I think it's a fantastic film. The Post, very good film. You know, all sorts of great, you know, great actors there. And
I will say also, I'm actually a lot further ahead with the nominees this year than I usually am.
Just catching up on what you didn't catch the first time around?
Out of all the nominees, I'm only missing one. Usually at this point, I'm missing maybe 3 or 4.
A mad scramble to watch them before.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Oh, I understand. I understand. I've been like that too. I know you're not a documentaries person, but
no, I'm not.
Thankfully this year, 3 out of the 5 nominees for Best Documentary have shown up on Netflix. So if you have a Netflix account and you're always wondering, who are these nominees for Best Documentary Feature? I've never heard of any of these films. You can go onto Netflix and watch Icarus, Last Man in Aleppo, and Strong Island. All 3 of those are available. And that's just available on streaming through Netflix. They also have Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, which is actually one of the few documentaries I did get to see in theaters this year. And it was fantastic. It's about a small Chinatown bank in New York, family-owned, who had an employee do some improprietary things. And they were really the only bank that was ever brought to trial over the whole savings and, or not savings and loan, but the whole mortgage crisis back in 2008.
Okay.
Where all the big banks got away with everything, this small little bank, the feds went after them. It would make a very good double feature with The Big Short. The Big Short kind of explaining all the mechanisms of that. And then, to give you that background, and then, you know, watching how this played out for one of the smaller players in that financial crisis. Faces Places, I've heard good things about, too. It's about filmmaker and artist Agnes Varda.
Okay.
And I've heard some really good strong raves for that. Hoping to be able to watch that as well. But I do know the other 3 films that are available on Netflix streaming, I am definitely set for. What categories are you excited for this year?
I need to go into the acting nominations.
Okay.
Holy moly, are we stacked.
Some great performances. Again.
Oh, God, yeah.
Again, it's one of those cases where, like, I would kick this person out to put this other person in because I wanted to see, I had more actors and roles that I would have liked to see nominated. But again, it's a case where I don't know who I would pull out.
I would only do that with one category.
Really? Who?
Lead actor, Denzel Washington. Pull him out and stick James Franco in there.
For Disaster Artist?
Yes.
Okay.
Full disclosure, when I saw Disaster Artist midway through, I wanted to walk out. Not because the film was bad. The film was amazing. Mm-hmm. But I had seen The Room a few nights before that, and it was uncanny. His performance to Tommy Wiseau was so scary that it was creeping me out.
Fair enough.
I wanted to walk out just because of that.
Okay.
And I think that deserves a nomination. I've never felt like that before going to see a film.
Interesting. No. Interesting in a very good way. That's a great reaction to have. I'm sure at some point Franco would be kind of proud about that. Or, thanks so much that, you know, it evoked that kind of emotional response.
I would be too if I was him. There are a couple of nominations that you're sitting there going, well, duh, there were no-brainers.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly Alice and Janney for I, Tonya.
Mm-hmm. And also Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird in supporting actress. And I think, honestly, it's going to come down to those two.
All right.
They're both, you know, mother roles. They're both excellently performed by actresses who've been, you know, working and honing their craft for years and years now.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of the fact that they're both playing mothers to the main character, they're far, far different characters.
I can't speak for Lady Bird, mm-hmm. but Alice and Janney's character is...
Is it reprehensible monster?
Is spiteful little, you know, water.
But that's what makes her interesting, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Is she's so awful. And Janney plays her just right. Just the right amount of awfulness. But there's just a hint of comedic undertones to it that you can't quite, you know, just be totally shocked and disgusted and turned off by her.
Well, I think that's part of the movie itself is because it is full of dark humor.
Yes. That whole movie, and like I said, it's one of my favorite films of the year. I know you. When you saw it, you were very...
I positive raving reviews. Yeah. It is not my favorite of the two. My two favorite films of this year that came up as nominees were Shape of Water and Call Me by Your Name.
Okay.
And Call Me by Your Name, I have to chalk that up to the performance by the lead actor, Timothée Chalamet.
Mm-hmm.
Chalamet, sorry. It's a difficult name to pronounce, but he was also in Lady Bird,
yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. And allow me just to use that to circle back for a moment to talk about Laurie Metcalf in Lady Bird, because she was amazing in that. And, you know, it's kind of that adversarial, angsty teen daughter, you know, the mom trying to put up with all that nonsense that the kid's throwing at her type of a role. But there's, you know, she does it, she kind of suffers it with a quiet dignity at points. Other times she's clearly exasperated, but she continues to do things for her daughter because she loves her. There's a moment in the film where she's just mending a dress or, you know, fixing it just a little bit so Lady Bird can wear it out to, I believe, the prom. It's just, you know, no one else in the house is around. She's just going about her work, doing what she needs to do for the family. And it's a nice, really quiet moment. It kind of hammers home the nature of that character, basically, is she puts up with a lot of crap from her kid. You know, I mean, my goodness, as we saw in the trailer, Lady Bird throws herself out of a car in the first 5 minutes of the film rather than be in it with her mom. So it's an amazing film. You know, Greta Gerwig wrote an incredible screenplay. You know, Laurie Metcalf is fantastic in it. And so, it's like I said, it's going to come down to either Metcalf or Janney for the Oscar in supporting actress, at least. But thank you for letting me detour now. Let's get back.
No,
you said your other favorite film in the Best Picture race there.
Oh, was Shape of Water and Call Me by Your Name were the two.
Yeah. And, well, you talked about you talked about Call Me by Your Name, but what really did you like about Shape of Water?
Everything.
Okay. Okay. Same here.
Particularly
moving on. No.
Particularly the performance by Sally Hawkins.
Oh, Hawkins is great. I mean, I've seen her in so many films in the last couple of years. Frances Ha springs to mind, where she was amazing.
Small roles in Godzilla, as well as Paddington.
Yeah, she does those, you know, pop films, I guess you could call them.
Yeah.
So she can, you know, she'll do like a Godzilla or a Paddington, so she can go back and do something like a Frances Ha.
Or like a Blue Jasmine.
Or Blue Jasmine, yes.
Which I still haven't seen, but I hear it's revelation to watch.
It's very good. I know Woody Allen is a little problematic these days, and we have to talk, and that's a whole conversation you have to go through with yourself. Do you
Says the person who mentioned Annie Hall earlier on.
I know, but... Do we only look at their material as problematic from the point of where it might have become? They might have been having their problematic episodes, I guess you could say. So anything he does up until his the dissolving of his marriage or his partnership with Mia Farrow, we can look at and be fine with or not.
Okay, I'm going to tangent for a moment.
Okay, tangent away.
I think when it comes down to the problems in Hollywood, I'm able to compartmentalize
okay.
performance and work from a person.
Okay.
So one of my favorite movies I love to watch is American Beauty. And I know that we're getting into hazy territory because okay. of Kevin Spacey.
Yes.
But I will sit down and I will still watch that movie. Why? Because I'm not watching Kevin Spacey. I'm watching Thora Birch. I am watching Chris Cooper. I'm watching Wes Bentley. I'm watching Allison Janney.
Okay.
I'm watching all those other actors and mm-hmm. give great performances. Even him give a great performance. Mm-hmm. I'm not watching Kevin Spacey. I'm watching his character.
Okay.
And I think it's the same with Woody Allen movies. I love Midnight in Paris. I absolutely love that mm-hmm. movie. It's a Woody Allen directed film. That's not going to stop me from watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Work and a person to me are two different things.
I understand. And, you know, there is the argument. It's not one that I generally would make. But they're saying, well, for an artist, the work is the person because it has to be personal and things like that. And I can see that to a point, but
to a certain degree.
I think on a case-by-case basis, though, you really have to make that decision. But let's circle back to the Oscars.
Please.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that could be a two-hour discussion we have at another time.
We were at Sally yes. Hawkins.
Yes.
Speaking of Sally Hawkins, her biggest candidate is, or her biggest competition is going to be Frances McDormand.
From Three Billboards.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
What a performance from her.
Oh, amazing. Frances McDormand has been giving out great performances year in, year out. Even something small, like when she shows up in Hail Caesar, where she's playing like the cigarette chain-smoking film editor. It's one scene, but you know, it's not a Coen Brothers movie without her, really. And
I feel like a lot of times Frances McDormand is taken for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't give her enough to do, but she still happens to fill the scene.
True.
She's got this this gravitas to her.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, I would have given her an Academy Award for Darkman, but that's just me. I love that movie. One thing, though, about Shape of Water that surprised me. Got four acting nominations out of there.
Three. We have yeah. Sally Hawkins.
Sally Hawkins, yep.
Richard Jenkins. And Octavia Spencer.
Mm-hmm. Very surprised we didn't see anything for Michael Shannon.
Well, you're amazing. Saying that because you're a Michael Shannon fan.
Yes, I am. I'll admit that. Michael Shannon's great. I'm also very surprised, or maybe not surprised, but a little upset or saddened, that Doug Jones didn't get an Oscar nomination for his role as the Gill Man, the assets,
the titular character, the fish guy, whatever.
Yeah, whatever you want to call him.
And I think that is a discussion for another podcast because we're getting into the territory of makeup and mocap and
why
the same
Andy
argument
Serkis?
With Andy Serkis.
Yes. Of course. So yeah, that's something to talk about at a future point. Where a performance ends and makeup and costuming begin, or and why can't people see past certain things like that?
Yeah. Whereas Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour, we know is in full makeup and mm-hmm. a fat suit and such to play the character of Winston Churchill.
True.
By the way, biggest contender for lead actor this year is Gary Oldman.
Yeah, I would say that. I would be pleasantly surprised if Daniel Kaluuya, I apologize if I slaughtered that name there, got it for Get Out. It'd be interesting to see, you know, how well Get Out does. I'm very excited Jordan Peele has that.
Writing, directing, and did he produce Get Out as well?
I think technically so, yeah. He would be up there to receive the Best Picture Oscar if they win. Like I said, again, it's so many great titles here. It's like, it's hard to find one that you're really pulling
yeah.
for. A lot of the big names got multiple nominations. So mm-hmm. if the Academy wants to, and I know the Academy does not get together and make a decision about this. It's made up of individuals. It's not a giant gestalt. If the Academy wanted to, they could spread the love around to a lot of these films very nicely.
But there are a couple of other categories that are just stacked. And I'm having a hard time figuring out which one would be the biggest contender.
Okay.
Or,
for example,
visual effects.
Okay. Who do you got?
We have Blade Runner 2049, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2,
mm-hmm.
Kong Skull Island,
mm-hmm.
Star Wars The Last Jedi, and War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. All of them, I can't think of like a clunker shot in any of those. I know some people complain about the look of the Princess Leia in space moment in Last Jedi. I don't have a problem with it because her cloak wouldn't ripple as she moves because there's no air for it to be rippling against.
Yeah.
So it you know, it makes, I know, and I'm trying to actually apply real world science to a Star Wars movie, which makes me sound like a moron. But
it's kind of negates the argument you were making earlier on about science and Star Wars.
Yes, I know. But I don't have a problem with any of the effects in any of those films. If you're looking, you know, are you judging on like artistic merit or technical merit? Artistically, Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, I would choose Blade Runner 2049 for visuals, production.
Oh gosh, production design, certainly.
Even when you're coming down to it, you also have the sound editing, sound mixing, and film editing categories where they're insane, particularly in sound. You've got Baby Driver, you've got Blade Runner, Dunkirk, Shape of Water, Star Wars in both categories.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the nominees for both of the categories.
Mm-hmm. Well, usually the sound categories go hand in hand anyways.
Sometimes, but not always.
Not always, but that's usually where the safe money bet is.
Oh, yeah, true. And I would say Blade Runner's biggest competition is Baby Driver.
True.
And Baby Driver, it, for me, first and foremost, is the headliner for film editing.
Mm-hmm.
Because sound and film editing for that movie were its strong suits.
Mm-hmm.
As we know for Baby Driver, a lot of the music, the soundtrack, the score, is all synced up to every single shot. So the moment someone takes a step, you're going to get a bump bump. Or,
yeah.
Like the one shot at the beginning of the film, he's walking down the street, he's gonna stop, he's gonna blow the horn with the graffiti in the background. Mm-hmm. It's a guy blowing a trumpet. It's all perfect. There isn't a flaw in that.
No.
And Blade Runner syncs up so much to the original film.
In terms of, like, echoes to the original film?
Yeah. Production, sound.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a different approach.
Yeah.
And they both work very well for their individual projects. So, yeah, that's going to be the fun of watching and see who wins. And it's going to be hard to be, like, angry about wins, I think, overall.
Yeah, no,
actually, the one category, actually, I'm kind of, like, I don't want to say irritated with, but I'm not very thrilled with, at least, is animated feature. And I know you haven't seen it. Have you seen any of the animated features?
None.
None. Okay. None. All right. I've seen them all with the exception of Loving Vincent, which I understand is amazing.
That's the one I am the most excited to actually watch.
Ferdinand is, it's just fine. It's animated kids' fair, family fair. It's meh. The Boss Baby is just not a good film. It was a very painful sit to get through all of that.
Oh, really?
It just wasn't that funny or that good, even. Before where I say, you know, in the best feature film category, there's not a title I would throw out to substitute something in. In animated feature, Boss Baby would be trashed out of that category so fast. And honestly, I'd put in the Lego Batman movie.
Really?
Yeah, I really like that film. I think it's a film that does a nice tribute to the 75, 80 years of the Batman character. It has a good sense of humor about itself. I think it understands the Batman character better than Zack Snyder's movies have. I really thought it was a fantastic film, and it's good for kids, it's good for adults. I think maybe because it opened in February of last year, it's kind of forgotten. But that would be like the one substitution I think I would make out of all of these nominees. I just watched The Breadwinner this morning. And maybe it's recency bias because, you know, I've only have it in my rearview mirror by a couple of hours. But I thought that was fantastic. It's a drama. It's kids can watch it, I would say. But it's certainly not a kid's movie. It's about a family living in that poor, you know, family living in Afghanistan under the rule of the Taliban. The father is arrested and sent off to a jail that they can't even go see him at. It's just the mother and two daughters and, you know, like a two-year-old son. And under the Taliban, women can't go out unaccompanied. So the younger daughter, who's, I guess, 11 or so, you know, kind of preteen, she cuts her hair and passes as a boy in order to go out to get food, to go out and work, to get money, to buy food. I don't want to say anything more about it than that, because there's some really great moments in that film. It's really, really good. Again, it's on Netflix streaming. It sounds like we're turning this into a Netflix-sponsored podcast, which we are not.
But it is
an we'll easy take way your money if you want to send some our way.
But it is a good way to see these films.
Yeah, it didn't get a wide distribution. And I wish it had, because I think, honestly, it would have been more part of the conversation if more people had seen it. I don't think it even got much of a distribution outside of the Oscar qualifying runs in New York and L.A. that it needs.
So content-wise, you would compare Breadwinner to, say, Persepolis?
Yes. Yes. It's a very good companion piece to Persepolis. There's two tracks of animation. First of all, you haven't really seen animation like this before. It has its own certain style and look. It's very nicely done. Part of the film is the girl telling her baby brother a story in little bits and pieces over the course of the film. And when she goes to tell that story, the animation design and everything switches, and it looks a little bit like the design work from a animated film a few years back called Sita Sings the Blues.
Okay. Yeah.
So again, another film, another animated film I think has been overlooked. So I liked that switch in the style between the two. So definitely, you know, seek that one out on Netflix, or, you know, if it's available on some other services. Honestly, I know everybody's head over heels in love with Coco because it's Pixar, and because, you know, it's very, like, warm and sentimental, and it has some nice tunes, and it's the Pixar-iest Pixar film that Pixar's Pixar'd. And I'm not saying that to be totally derogatory. I do like Coco, but if I was choosing any of these films based on their merits as films, irregardless, which I know is not a word, of who made them, I would go with The Breadwinner. Quite honestly. Really? Yes.
I will need to check out The Breadwinner. I know a lot of people are head over heels with Coco because it has the same power as Black Panther or Wonder Woman. It is catering to a demographic that is easily overlooked.
True. Oh, definitely. I would agree with that. You know, a Latino community representation in film is either they're bad guys or muggers or, you know, other types of bad guys like that, or they're the wacky sidekick to Paul Rudd in Ant-Man. And I don't know why a comedic lead character needs a wacky sidekick as well, but
I cannot believe that I just defended Pixar. I am not a big Pixar fan. I'm not a big animated fan, period, when it comes to 3D animation. I prefer classic 2D animation because there was I feel like there was an artistry to a handheld drawing. Mm-hmm. It's so particular that you have to get every little meticulous detail right. The same could be said for 3D animation. It could be just as hard to transfer that.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Do you consider using a computer then cheating? Because the computer will keep that model and you just manipulate the model?
A bit, yes.
So following that logic, is anything Henry Selick did in terms of stop motion, like James and the Giant Peach, cheating because he's using models and moving them very slightly frame to frame to frame?
Again, you're going to hate me. Not a big stop motion fan either.
Oh my goodness.
James and the Giant Peach, Coraline.
I think I just have to cancel this podcast right now.
So the one I am rooting for the most out of this, and I still haven't seen it, but I'm going to try to find it. I don't know if it's been released yet or not, is Loving Vincent.
Yes.
Because of the artistry that went behind this, it is a biopic about Vincent van Gogh. Mm-hmm. And it does have great casts such as Saoirse Ronan, Douglas yes. Booth. It is a stacked cast. But the artistry, they had, I think it was 70 artists sitting down, and frame by frame, they would shoot the film and then transfer it over to the artist, and they would have to paint every single frame and every single shot in the style of Van Gogh's paintings.
Yes, I know. That's what, you know, when I heard that was going on with that film, I was like, oh my goodness, I need to see that. And that's still one of the few things I haven't seen. And I hate to go into the Academy Awards without having seen that, but it does sound fascinating. The few clips that I've seen online look beautiful.
Oh, and one last thing I would like to discuss with you. I know. You and I said we needed to have this talk. Original song.
Oh, that's right. Original song.
I wanted to remind you before you decided to wrap up on it.
Fair enough. So, original song. Which song do you think is going to walk away with it?
Well, as much as I'd like to say it would be Mysteries of Love from Call Me By Your Name, I think the no-brainer of what's going to walk away with the award is This Is Me from The Greatest Showman.
It's a strong contender. I'll give you that. It's a great moment in the film. A film that I liked but did not love. I know you liked it more than I did. I think it could go to This Is Me, or I think the only competition it really has is Remember Me from Coco.
Okay.
Because I think Remember Me is such a part of the story itself. That song forms a spine through that story that I think if the Academy, again, if voters, you know, kind of think about it, songs in that way. Is it just a nice song? Can I hear it on the radio or whatever? Sure. Remember Me is a nice song. But how does it function in terms of the movie itself? Does it add to the story? Does it, you know, become a part of the story the way the song does? You know, it's played a couple of different times in the movie, and each time has different significance. There's a flexibility to it that allows that kind of change in significance over the various times it is used. And as a storytelling device, I would say Remember Me is maybe stronger than This Is Me.
Storyline-wise, I will agree with you based on what you have told me.
Thank you.
but This Is Me is a contender not because of using it as a plot device. It's probably the biggest contender because of the meaning behind it. It is an anthem. It is an anthem for the movie. It's a call to anyone who has ever felt segregated or pushed away by society. I mean, even teenagers who are being bullied in middle school. It is a way for them to say, look at me. You don't scare me. I am proud of who I am, and I will stand here and fight for whatever I believe in, and nothing you say can shoot me down.
Okay, so it's a anthemic statement of the film's theme.
Not just of the film's theme, but as a society. I mean, we are living in a society in which things are getting easier for certain demographics, but there are still people out there who feel afraid to show themselves. I mean, a lot of people who come out for the LGBTQ community, they could hear this song. And they might have been afraid to show who they are. And this could make them proud enough to stand up and say, this is who I am, I'm not afraid of it, and nothing you can say or do is going to make me change who I am.
Okay, so it has a resonance beyond the textual meaning in the film itself.
Exactly.
Okay, I can see that. Yeah, I would definitely agree with you that. So
they used it.
Two good arguments for each song there. Yeah.
They actually used This Is Me during the Super Bowl for a spot for the Olympics. And it wasn't just any Olympics. I think it might have been the Paralympics. I meant the Special Olympics. That right there, the use of that song goes to show that it is more than just radio fodder or a plot device. It's actually making waves in our society and our community.
Okay. You've convinced me. Both of those songs could win.
Yes, they could.
And we'll find out in a week.
Oh, looking forward to it.
Yes, the Oscars are next Sunday, March the 4th. And I believe we're going to record our next episode immediately after the Oscars end.
Oh,
so you will get that following Monday the 5th. You will get our immediate hot takes, as the kids say. But in the meantime, though, we'll be right back in just a moment with some recommendations.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
And before we close things out, we want to share a couple of recommendations of some recent film-related things we've come across or watched with all of you. I'm going to go first, and I'm going to recommend the Fathom Events re-release into theaters of Dark Crystal. If you're familiar with Fathom Events, you know that they take classic films and get them out in the theaters for one or two showings during a week. And Jim Henson's dark fantasy here is amazing. This is not the Muppet Show, people. This is Jim Henson working in a completely different mode from the Muppets. Sure, it's puppetry at its core, but it's so much more than that. It's amazing the imagination that's on display here in this fantasy world of Gelflings and Skeezics and all sorts of amazing creatures that he and his comrades, who all worked on the Muppets, including, you know, the likes of Frank Oz, come together and create such an amazingly realized cinematic world for this film.
Would you compare it to Labyrinth? Or
I think it's a step or two beyond Labyrinth.
Really?
In terms of the imagination on the screen. Labyrinth, you at least had some human characters. You don't in Dark Crystal. You have nobody who's a human being. You have a character who's certainly your audience surrogate, but they're not human. They're a Gelfling. They're kind of like an elf-type character. Kind of humanish, but again, the character's realized through puppetry. And I think it's just an amazing piece of fantasy. There was a lot of amazing fantasy films in the 80s that I think people kind of remember. Things like Legend and Lady Hawk, which is another wonderful film. And I think Dark Crystal kind of fits right in with that tradition there, where in the wake of the Star Wars trilogy, people were starting to, filmmakers were starting to stretch their imaginations in different ways, and you still had studios willing to take that financial risk. You don't see that too much anymore these days. So Dark Crystal's been out on home video forever. People have seen it. A lot of people have seen it.
But I haven't seen it. I'm going this week.
Though. Okay.
I will be seeing it it's the 28th.
I was going to say, but there's probably a whole generation or two generations at this point who have not had the chance to see it on the big screen. So if you know a kid or a kid at heart who wants to see a great fantasy film, Fathom Events has Dark Crystal out in theaters on February 28th, and then again next week in March 3rd and 6th. I would recommend, checking out your local theaters to see if they're going to be hosting one of those screenings. Mm-hmm. Natasha, what's your recommendation?
I will be recommending a movie called In a Lonely Place with Humphrey Bogart. I saw it this week, and 4 minutes in, I was already sitting there going, I'm already in love with this movie. And it takes quite a bit to get me to an area where I can say that early on in a film.
Mm-hmm.
I had that feeling when I went to see Shape of Water. I had that feeling when I saw Call Me By Your Name. And I had that feeling when I watched Double Indemnity. And I had it again last night. Knowing that I loved it that early on in usually makes it a safe bet that it's going to end up in my collection.
And Criterion has a very nice release of
it.
So I would recommend if anybody's looking to get a copy of In a Lonely Place, track down the Criterion.
It came out in 1950. Mm-hmm. It stars Humphrey Bogart as a has-been screenwriter who's trying to come back, but he ends up finding himself in the middle of a murder investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this whole thing throughout the film of did he, didn't he? He's also falling in love with a woman, and she's kind of having the same feeling of did he or didn't he, and should I be afraid of him or not, but I love him. And it is a rough watch. Amazing rough watch, and I would say probably one of the best performances I've ever watched Bogart give.
Oh yeah, I would definitely agree with you there. It's a movie I was introduced to back in college by my friend Brandon, and I can't thank him enough for pushing that tape into my hand back then. It's amazingly complex performance from Bogart. And there's also some great character actors in there too. Art Smith as his as his agent, Mel, is so fun. And I, you know, he's just a guy who you'd probably have seen him in a bunch of old movies, and you don't think about him. But whenever he pops up, you're like, oh, there's that guy. And I think that's a nice performance. Gloria Graham is fantastic as the love interest in the movie Laurel.
I remember messaging you going, I love Miss Gray. I love her already. And I think I was only, I'd say about a minute and a half to 2 minutes into her introduction when I made that call.
Oh, yeah. It's just a great film. And but this is your recommendation.
No, I can't thank you enough for recommending it to me. And I, in turn, am recommending it to everyone who will listen to this podcast. It is a brilliant film. There is a lot to be said about the ending of the movie itself, which I won't go into because of spoilers. But I will admit, as we started getting to the point of the climax of that ending, right before the slide down, I dropped an oh my god when I was watching it.
Yeah, you.
It was a real shock moment for me because of the performance that Bogart is giving.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrifying. I was actually scared.
As they say in the movie itself, it's a wow finish.
It is. Yes. It is a very wow finish.
And it's a wow finish then, I guess, too, for this installment of the Big Picture Podcast. Before we wrap up, though, we'll be back next week with our immediate hot take post-Oscar episode. But until then, where can people find you online?
Film Buff Online, obviously.
Okay, yes. As you can find my writing as well at filmbuffonline.com. Until then, though, thank you so much for tuning in.
And join us next week on the Big Picture Podcast. This is my-